court will proceed to the in the case of United States versus Sam. We're taking on the briefs. We'll proceed to the fifth case for argument, I guess. United States versus Darif. Mr. Sheets.
May it please the court.
I've got this wrong. What your name, please?
Ray Sheets.
Ray Sheets, okay.
Good morning. Again, my name is Ray Sheets. I am here on behalf of Mr. Darif. I am from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. This case comes from the Central District of Illinois. The case deals with four issues primarily. The first two issues deal with the jury instructions given in the case, or the lack of jury instructions. Mr. Darif was charged with marriage fraud, one count of conspiracy to commit marriage fraud, one count, substantive count, and one count of witness tampering. In regards to the witness tampering, Section 1512B, which prohibits a defendant from knowingly using intimidation, threats, or corruptly persuading. And the defendant in this case was charged with the corruptly persuading option of 1512B. When we got to trial and it was time for jury instructions, the court did not instruct the jury what corruptly persuading means. And it's not a term that is easily defined by an average layperson, or as we found out through the United States Supreme Court Arthur Anderson case, corruptly persuade is not a term that's easily defined by the circuit courts or the federal district courts of the United States. Just last week, in the Second Circuit, United States versus Quattrone, the stockbroker case from New York City, there was also an issue in regards to what corruptly persuades means. And Mr. Quattrone's conviction was reversed based on an improper jury instruction in that case. In this case, the district court provided no jury instruction as to what corruptly persuades means. And I cited a case in my reply brief that the Seventh Circuit has stated that the district court does have that obligation to provide definitions of, quote, enigmatic terms, unquote. And if the court fails to do so, that is reversible error. And in the case I cited from the Seventh Circuit, Miller versus Nethery, a 1995 case, the district court failed to define what recklessly means.
Well, didn't the court use the instruction that Darif presented and advised his counsel if he wanted an instruction on the meaning of the term, he should present a new one to the court, but he never did? That's a problem for you. Isn't that a waiver?
Well, no, it's not a waiver. I mean, the fact that a definition of corruptly persuaded wasn't provided to the district court
And it was, counsel was invited to provide one.
Well, counsel raised the issue with the district court. It wasn't an issue that was waived by defense counsel. Defense counsel affirmatively stated that we believe that a definition would help the jury in this case. Now, defense counsel in that case did not have access to a computer or a word processor to type up a definition of corruptly persuades. In any event, that doesn't excuse the district court.
It could not have read an instruction to the court that the court couldn't have transcribed.
Well, the one of the problems is that the Seventh Circuit does not have a uniform instruction on what corruptly persuades means.
Right.
And it doesn't even have a uniform instruction on witness tampering.
Right.
So as the transcript reflects, I mean, counsel and the court went through the Seventh Circuit uniform jury instructions, and we couldn't find a uniform instruction. And so that was part of the problem in that nobody really knew where to look for a definition of what corruptly persuades means. And it's not a term that you can, just off the cuff suggest to the court what it means. It's a term that has been the cause of a lot of case law and confusion as to what that term means. And so, nevertheless, I think that that confusion would have encouraged the court to give some direction to the jury as to what corruptly persuades means, because there was no threats, there was no intimidation. The case came down to what corruptly persuades means. The second issue in regards to jury instructions was the actual marriage fraud jury instructions. And in that case, there was prior case law that gave clear elements as to the elements of marriage fraud. And the defense counsel provided First Circuit a case and a couple of Ninth Circuit cases.
Let me just go back to that other instruction, though. So I guess your position would be that because it would have been a struggle for everybody to come up with a definition, it was just abandoned. So, I mean, did counsel say then this count should be thrown out because we can't define this term? I mean, I just find that I understand there's tension and there was conflicts in the law, but it seems to me that counsel should have taken a shot at it, you know, and if you know the law is unsettled to try to suggest an instruction to the court. I mean, this does happen, you know, with some frequency that, you know, that there are issues that the court needs to instruct on, and there may not be a clear instruction, and you kind of parcel or find language and put something together. That just troubles me that, you know, that would be your position. Just sort of.
Well, we're certainly not asking that you throw out any count. We're asking that the court remand the case.
But I'm saying if the law is in such a state of confusion you can't even instruct the jury, then maybe that count needs to go. I mean,
there are a couple important things. One, no uniform instruction on tampering. Secondly, no uniform instruction on corruptly persuades. Third, the Arthur Anderson case, which is now the bedrock for corrupt persuasion, wasn't decided until a month after this trial. And so there was no guidance that one could easily look at to see a clear definition.
Well, there were jury instructions submitted in Arthur Anderson, right?
I would assume so.
Yeah. I'm just saying that, yeah, I know you didn't have the ruling, but, I mean, they made an attempt, too. I just have trouble with that argument. That's all. You can move on.
Okay. The second jury instruction argument went to the elements of marriage fraud, and in that case there was prior case law that clearly set forth the elements of marriage fraud. And in this case, the court did not instruct the jury that a defendant could have, first of all, the jury was to look at the defendant's intent at the time of the marriage, whether or not the defendant had a intent to establish a life with his spouse. Secondly, the defense asked the court to instruct the jury that, quote, a marriage is legitimate so long as defendant intended to establish a life together, even if securing an immigration benefit was one of the factors that led to the marriage. And that element comes directly from the Ninth Circuit, which, of course, handles a number of immigration cases. And the district court found that that was not a proper element. So in this case, the jury only had the instruction where was there a marriage? Did the defendant know that the marriage was entered into for evading a provision of the immigration law? And third, did the defendant have reason to know his conduct was unlawful? The second element, the knowingly entered a marriage for the purpose of evading a provision of the immigration law, isn't enough to instruct the jury that a defendant can marry, and one of the reasons being he was marrying was to obtain an immigration benefit. And the jury wasn't instructed of that in this case. And I cited the Ninth Circuit cases that set that forth in my brief. The third issue was in regards to marital privilege. In this case, the ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, went out to the defendant's wife's home and asked her to provide them with all of the letters that the defendant had written to her during the time that he was in custody. And there were probably six or seven letters that Ms. Kirkland provided to ICE. And then those letters were used as a sole basis for the tampering charge and were introduced at trial. The defense argued unsuccessfully at the district court that those letters were protected by privilege. The court relied upon the fact that 4 years earlier, the marriage had been fraudulently entered into, and thus 4 years later, even if there was a legitimate marriage, that initial marriage made, I guess, all correspondence between the two unprivileged. The final argument and issue is in regards to the selective prosecution, and just set forth as I think Justice Stevens set forth, nothing is as emphatic as zero. In this case, the two Middle Easterners were indicted and the two Americans were not. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sheets. Mr. Mahako?
May it please the court. My name is John Mahachko. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Central District of Illinois. And I would like to start with the witness tampering instruction. As counsel pointed out, and I'm not sure if it's clear from counsel's argument, but the Arthur Anderson case came out after this case. We didn't have the benefit of that case. The fact of the matter is that the Arthur Anderson case involved a very different instruction. And the issue in Arthur Anderson was that corruptly persuaded was not defined correctly. And in fact, what the court pointed out is that it allowed a conviction, watered down the corrupt element of the statute, in essence, that it allowed a conviction for innocent conduct. That wasn't the case here. And the jury instruction read, it's very clear that the jury instruction was that the defendant corruptly persuaded Ms. Kirkland to provide a false testimony. There's no question that that involved wrongful conduct. So this isn't a situation where the jury could have convicted for somehow some sort of innocent conduct. It's attempting to get her to provide false testimony. And that was set out in the jury instructions. That's an important thing to note. As far as the marriage fraud instructions go, and I should back up with the witness tampering instruction, and I know the court's already addressed the issue. The defendant waived the issue. It's the government's contention in this case. I don't know what else he would have the judge do. The court accepted the defendant's own instruction. After the court had accepted that instruction, the defendant said, well, I don't know, maybe corruptly persuades could confuse the jury. The court specifically asked the defendant, what do you want me to do? And the defendant said, well, is there a pattern instruction? The judge looked. He said, no, there isn't. And as the court's noted, specifically told the defendant, if you want an instruction, you need to present one to the court. There are cases, there are dictionaries, I'm sure it's out there somewhere. If you're asking me to do something, present an instruction and let me rule on it. The defendant didn't do that, and I think under those circumstances clearly waived the issue on appeal. As far as the marriage fraud instructions go, again, the standard review is abuse of discretion, whether the district court abused its discretion. The entire issue in this case was whether the defendant had the intent to enter into a fraudulent marriage at the time. He specifically said, I loved this woman. I didn't know there was any fraud going on. I didn't know about money changing hands. Even though I'd applied twice to come to the United States previously, that wasn't the reason I married her. I married her for love. That was one side of the story. The other side of the story was the abundant evidence of marriage fraud. The jury was asked to decide what the defendant's intent was at the time of the offense, and I think made the only reasonable inference from these facts that it was with the intent to evade the immigration laws. In the absence of a pattern instruction, the court tracked the statutory language, which is the appropriate procedure, and fairly presented the defendant's defense, which was intent, to the jury. Finally, the marital privilege issue is covered in detail in the briefs, but I would just note that the sham marriage exception is well recognized. The purpose of the marital privileges, both marital privileges, is to protect the marital relationship. When the marriage itself is a sham, there's nothing to protect. That's the Supreme Court's Lutwak decision. And in this case, certainly the sham marriage exception applies, as does the joint participant exception. The defendant and his wife were co-conspirators in the marriage fraud and can't seek to invoke the privilege to protect the communications in furtherance of that fraud. For all those reasons, and unless the court has any questions of me, I'd like to return the balance of my time and ask that the court affirm the conviction.
Thank you. I have one question. That's just then the immigration. Is he still in prison?
No, Your Honor, he's not.
Where is he now?
I believe he's in Rock Island.
Is he going to be deported?
My understanding is that immigration proceedings are ongoing but have essentially been stayed pending the outcome of the criminal appeal in this case.
Are they still ostensibly married, as far as you know?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. As far as I know, if he's back in Rock Island, my guess is that they are. One thing that is important to note, the defendant's argument that somehow you can ratify a fraudulent marriage has no support in the case law. But even if it did, the testimony in this case was from Ms. Kirkland that she didn't decide that she loved the defendant until after all these letters that are at issue were written. In fact, she gave a date, October 20th of 2004. That's in the trial transcript at pages 175 and 176. She decided that's when she loved the defendant. So even under the theory that...
It wasn't love at first sight then, huh?
The testimony was, Your Honor, that he fell in love with a picture of her over the Internet. The two of them were unable to communicate because of the language barrier. He fell in love with a picture and decided a week later that he was going to marry her, and then approximately 4 weeks after that, she was in Morocco and they were married. So, a lot of evidence of fraud in this case. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Sheets?
Thank you. In response to your question, Your Honor, Mr. Darif and his wife are in the courtroom today. They're still together. They're still married. They're still living together as man and wife. And for the government to say that that's not relevant is something that I don't agree with.
Well, what about the position the government takes that you cannot ratify a fraudulent marriage? I mean, that doesn't vitiate an initial fraud if established.
Well, I disagree with that. I mean, we have 5 years of a track record now of a couple that's still married. Yeah. You know, she's been very supportive of Mr. Darif, her husband, since this case has started.
So what's your case law? I understand that's your view of it, but what's the case law that supports that position, that you can have that ratification post?
Well, there is. I mean, this is a unique case. This is, I mean, 99.9% of marriage fraud cases are a couple gets married, they split up, never see each other again. In this case, we have a couple that, yes, wife entered into the marriage fraudulently, but as I asked the court to instruct the jury at the time of trial, just because wife entered into the marriage fraudulently doesn't mean spouse, my client, had the same intent. And as the trial transcript is full of, Ms. Darif told the agents, my husband, it never appeared that he knew what was happening. And so we showed the joint filing of tax returns. We presented the testimony of family members who say they always appeared at family functions together, acted as husband and wife. But we did have the clear evidence of the wife 5 years ago accepting $3,000 to marry her, or marry him. And that's one of the arguments that I make in regards to marital privilege. The court said, well, because she accepted that money in 2000, here we are in 2005, the marital privilege still doesn't apply because in 2000 the marriage was entered into fraudulently. And my argument was, what if they were married 24 years? Is the district court's position still the same? And does the marital privilege still not apply because 24 years ago, instead of 4 years ago, they entered into a marriage? people, I mean, our culture is unique in that supposedly we fall in love because we get married because we fall in love. I mean, probably 75% of the other cultures in around the globe marry for completely different reasons. And one of the reasons being purely financial. And it was important for the jury to have been instructed that, yes, a defendant can consider a immigration benefit in making a marital decision. And in this case, the jury didn't get to hear that. I mean, that's a clear case law out of the Ninth Circuit. And in this case, the only instruction that they had was did Mr. Reef accept money for the marriage? And she did. 5 years later, they're still together. They're still here together, despite the government's every efforts to separate them.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sheets. My thanks to both counsel. Mr. Sheets, you accepted the appointment in this case. Is that correct? Well, you have the additional thanks to the court for your able representation of the defendant in this case. All right. The case is, as I say, under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.